Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, we're taking a look back at two Bullseye interviews with stone cold music legends. Two music legends who happen to be from Cincinnati, Ohio, where this show just started airing. First up, Bootsy Collins from 2011. Bootzilla, the pride of the Natty, one of pop music's greatest bass players, legendary for his contribution to James Brown and the JBs and to Parliament Funkadelic and to his own band, Bootsy's Rubber Band, and to many, many, many years of hits. He's the owner of one of the heaviest bass sounds in the world and one of the architects of funk. Earlier this summer, he dropped a new single called Stars. It features Dr. Cornel West, Steve Jordan, Bella Fleck, and many, many more. It's part of a fundraiser for the Music Cares COVID-19 Relief Fund put on by the Grammys. Let's listen.
As a people, we have crawled before. The struggle is pretty hard to ignore. And on occasion, we take it for granted. And we forget all the seeds that were planted.
Bootsy Collins, welcome to Bullseye.
What's going on, Jesse? How are you?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing really good, man. And, you know, just getting back out here on the road and doing that thing. And it's coming, connecting with the people again. It's a good thing.
I want to ask you about learning to play the bass. I know that your somewhat older brother, who you played with for many, many years, was a guitar player.
Yeah.
Was it that sort of classic situation where your brother got the glamour spot and you ended up playing the bass?
Well, not exactly. It was kind of more like he played guitar and I wanted to play guitar as well. So I started off playing guitar, but one night, his bass player couldn't make a gig, and I wanted to play with him so bad it didn't matter what I played. You know, I could have played drums or I could have played piano, which I had no idea how to do at the time. I would have told him, let me do it, you know. So it really didn't matter. And we did this gig, and I was playing bass, and, you know, it just felt so right.
You've always said that you wanted to play bass the way that Jimi Hendrix played guitar.
Yes.
I wonder both how you ended up feeling that way and also whether your brother, being almost of another generation but also being a guitarist, was on the same wavelength as you.
Well, I don't, probably not, but you know, that's kind of, I came in at a time where Jimmy was like, God, I mean, I just felt like, man, this cat just not only musically, but cosmically just opened the whole world up to me. You know, he made me see that I could not only play, you know, all these wild things and all these different wild sounds that I'm hearing. He showed me that I could even dress as crazy as I wanted to. And I always looked up to him for that. Even when I was with James Brown, sitting on the back of the bus, you know, popping acid and smoking weed and listening to Jimi Hendrix. That wasn't allowed on James Brown's bus. Man, where are you from? You know, you don't do that. But I did that. And I wasn't doing it to be snobby or take this, James Brown, or none of that. It was just, that's what time it was, and that's where I was at, and that's where my whole heart was at.
When did you first meet James Brown in person?
That was when they were recording, what year was that? They were recording Lick and Stick. What year was that? That was 60-something. I forget the exact year.
Wow. Mama, come here quick and bring that Lick and Stick.
And when the band took a break, he called us in, and our rhythm section got a chance to play Lick and Stick. I guess he was testing us to see what we felt like with him.
Could you tell it was a test at the time?
Oh no, no, not at all. I didn't even care what it was at the time. It was it was like, man, I get the opportunity to play, for James Brown. I mean, it didn't even matter what it was. James Brown asked us to do this. And if we had never got to play with James Brown, that in itself probably would have been enough for me at that time. It was like, it was just incredible.
Mama, come here quick and bring that licking stick. Now look at you, Junior, don't kill me.
James Brown was famous for his incredible drive and perfectionism that maybe even bordered on madness.
I think you're right. I think it did border on madness, because every time we'd play a show, he'd call us in the back room and say,
"Nah, son, you just ain't got it. You ain't got the one."
every show we had to hear this, and it was like, we knew we were killing him. We knew that the people were just amazed at, our sound and what was going on, at the show. We knew it, and then he would call us back and tell us that. And I didn't realize till years later that it only made me want to practice that much harder. Us as a band, it made us want to get as tight and play as tight as we possibly can. So all of what he was telling us, he was using reverse psychology on us, and we didn't have a clue. It was more about, this is James Brown telling us this.
Don't jump on my train when I'm out of sight. Just check yourself and say, yeah, you're right.
They have this saying in baseball that winning is the best chemistry.
Yeah.
And I imagine that part of what made you feel good about doing, about working for a, despotic ruler.
Yeah.
Was the fact that you were in a band that was undisputedly the best and untouched even since then.
And I wanted to know how to be and how you get to be the best like that. I wanted to know that. I wanted to feel that. I wanted to be a part of that, I wasn't getting that from out there in the street. That part would have to come from James Brown, and I knew who I was with, even at that young age, and I wanted to get as much of it as I could.
When did you realize that this huge sort of schism in your career, this huge breaking point, was an opportunity for you to pursue being the Jimi Hendrix of the bass guitar?
Well, I guess when it first happened, I didn't know what to think. We were so messed up that, on the ride home, about, man, can you believe we just, we're not playing with James Brown anymore. We're on the way home. What we gonna tell mama? That's like, that was my initial thought. Like, what am I gonna tell mama? She just knows I'm out here just having, a good time with James Brown. I'm gonna be with James Brown. This is forever, man.
And you're sending checks home too.
For the first time in my life. A real check, we get home and I get through that phase of it. We get straight to rehearsing, putting the band back together and putting shows together. And that part you're talking about, getting to the Jimi Hendrix phase of it, I think kind of evolved as the band evolved. When we got with George Clinton, I think that was when I first realized, I can do this now. This is the time to do this. It was in the perfect situation with the perfect freak, George himself, who was not only behind it, but was instigating it.
Talking about you, man. Let's take it to the stage.
I gave to George any and everything that I could come up with, and he was open to accept it. And as a matter of fact, he wanted to see what I had to bring to the table. And so that inspired me. He allowed me to go in the studio and experiment. You know, he didn't look at me strange when I started bringing pedals and hooking up the bass to it. And he wanted the experiment. You know, it was like, bring everything you got because George wants it. So he was the whole opposite of what James Brown was.
That was Up for the Downstroke by Parliament, one of the first songwriting collaborations between George Clinton and my guest, bassist Bootsy Collins. It seems like George Clinton's great revolution was that he brought in all these brilliant players.
Yeah.
You know, notably among others, Fred Wesley from the JBs. I mean, Gary Scheider.
Yeah, well, actually, I brought Fred and Maceo, you know, when I came, because when we was with James Brown, I had always spoke with Fred and Maceo about, would y'all play in my band once I get it together and this, that, and the other? And they said, sure, man, you know, because, you know, didn't nobody really believe it, you know. But when I got with George and I called him, and they were so sick and fed up with James Brown, they was like, we ready, man. We ready. You know, what do you need us to do? They came straight to Detroit, and they joined the mothership.
It seems like the revolution really was George Clinton realized he could be the guy who could tell all of these other brilliant musicians, hey, why don't we try doing something crazy together?
Yeah. Well, you know what? It wasn't even about George saying, hey, let's try something crazy. He already had the crazy going on. It was just giving us an outlet to be crazy. And he would allow us to do any and everything we wanted to do. And to have this kind of referee in your corner, you know, people just don't get that. You either have, no, you can't do this and you can't do that. They got so many different rules and regulations that they really cut the musicians' creativity off. George was the complete opposite. He was voting for your creativity. He was, you know, he was like a fan of your creativity. He wanted you to bring it all, and he was rooting for you.
Hit it, fellas.
One of the things that's really amazing to me about P-Funk when it really got rolling in the mid-70s is that it was so broad.
Yeah.
In that there were these Parliament records that were just like a heavy, funky version, a great radio music.
Yeah.
And then there's these funkadelic records that are just insane.
Right.
And you've got a group, and all the lady singers have a group, and Fred Wesley has a group, and everybody's making music together in all these different avenues.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, you know, that was the, I think that was more of the genius of George's mind, where he saw like Berry Gordy, but only it was like his freak flag. He just flew it. Not only he flew it, he was a part of it. He was in it, and he was encouraging it. And his whole house was what you got. This was George's house. He had all of these different groups signed to these different major labels. These are not small labels. I mean, major label companies. that George, you know, hooked up and had us signed to. And that was incredible.
More with Bootsy Collins still to come. After a quick break, the star sunglasses and why Bootsy Collins put them on. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Some days, reading a bunch of headlines just isn't enough. You need to let the news sink in. On Consider This, NPR's new daily news podcast, we can help you do that. Each day, in about 10 minutes, you can find out not just what happened, but why and what it means. Consider This. New episodes every weekday afternoon from NPR.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek? Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about butts.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too.
Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind?
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, we're hearing my 2011 conversation with the one and only Bootsy Collins. He's one of pop music's greatest bass players. He's played with James Brown, Parliament Funkadelic, Snoop Dogg, you name it. Let's get back to our conversation.
When was the first time you put on your star sunglasses and became the Bootsy who we know as Bootsy?
Wow. It was in 1975. That's when I first put them on because I stumbled across, well, first of all, I went out looking for two things. One thing was a person to make the star bass, which I call the space bass, and the star glasses. I knew that I needed these things. I used to draw them all the time at school. Star glasses on the stick man, you know, and he had a star guitar. I used to draw that all the time. I never knew it would wind up being me. But when I got the opportunity, when George gave me the opportunity to do a solo thing, I was like, man, I can't look like anybody else. I gotta, you know, I want to see through stars. You know, I want to not only see through stars, I want to have star glasses on that are like mirrors. So when the kids look at me in my face, they see themselves. So this was a whole concept that I kind of had dreamed up. I was on a mission because I was, you know, recording a record at this particular time in 1975. I was recording a record and I'm thinking, okay, pretty soon we're going to have to take pictures for this. And I got to have these two things that I know I need. And so our manager, George's manager, who actually wound up managing me, lived out in L.A., so I got a chance to come out to L.A. and stay for a couple of weeks. So in that couple of weeks, I'm trying to find this person that makes these star glasses. Who's going to make these star glasses? So I'm walking up and down the street, broke as heck, you know, and wanting these star glasses. So I happen to wind up in a place called Optique Boutique, and I asked them, because they had so many different weird glasses. Actually, they had Elton John's glasses in the up in the window. And I was like, this is the place. This is the place. I went in there and started talking to the guy, and we got to kicking it, and he realized I was an up-and-coming musician that really didn't have no money, but the idea sounded great to him. And he put it together for me for $250.
It was a movement that really had 10 solid years. And
yeah.
I wonder if it was hard for that to stay together when everyone was so much doing their own thing. And also everyone was so high.
Wow. I would probably say the first 5 years, it really wasn't hard. I think it became really hard when everybody started realizing money is being made. That's when And that's usually when, you know, well, especially back in that time, that's when the problem really started, you know. And then the other problem was George was having more fun than anybody, you know, and...
he's supposed to be steering the ship.
Yeah, he's supposed to be, you know, he's the commander of the ship, and he's acting a bigger fool than anybody, you know, which was fun. It was funny as heck, but at the same time, wasn't nobody, you know, everybody felt like they wasn't getting paid. And I think that was the last 5 years of what you're talking about.
I get the impression that maybe George Clinton was the kind of guy who, rather than maliciously taking money for himself,
he
was simply operating on the principle that we should just spend whatever we need to spend to do anything that we can think of,
and then funk it,
including like motherships and just drugs for everybody.
And then
his plan was just, well, we'll just try and make enough money to cover that.
Well, you know, he didn't even have a plan. You know, it was more like, you know, back in the day, when you would come to somebody's house, you know, you would come in, you know, it was like, you know, here, have a joint. Come on, have a seat, you know. And then you would kick it. You would crack jokes. And, you know, so that's George's whole mentality. You know, it wasn't about no business. You know, he wasn't. James Brown was like a businessman. You know, George didn't want to have nothing to do with the business. You know, he was just out to have a good time on the mothership. He was, you know, the director. You know, he was, you know, driving the mothership. He was just having a great time, you know. And as long as everybody could roll with that, then, you know, we'll all have a great time, you know. And I think that was a great opportunity, and that was a great time and a great vibe that George had, you know. But at the same time, you know, everybody was, you know, was getting hit with bills and couldn't pay this, was getting married and having babies, and the responsibility thing started kicking in. And George, you know, he's not responsible for nothing, you know, and he'll let you know that.
May you live as long as you want, but never want as long as you live, baby.
While living in a world of freedom.
You've been recording regularly through your entire career. And yeah. I think that your new album, which is called The Funk Capital of the World, is kind of different. There's this thing called the griot, which is a kind of a West African tradition of storytelling that a lot of like culture theorists point to as the source for a lot of African American musical culture. It's a kind of storytelling that's married with music. And there's a lot of storytelling on this record. There's Al Sharpton talking about James Brown. There's a really great track with Samuel Jackson talking about growing up.
Samuel, yeah.
Let me drop a little knowledge about how I got from Chattanooga, Tennessee to big city, L.A.
Why did you want to make that the centerpiece of this album?
Well, mainly because I felt like it was time to, I call it spreading hope like dope. You know, it's like, I felt like, you know, I wanted this record to be bigger than a me record. And meaning... bigger than just me putting out a Bootsy record or a Bootsy Rubber Band record. I wanted it to be something totally different. And I needed to get storytellers because I felt it was really necessary for not only today, but the generations to come. So it will kind of point back to where I got my funk from and how we grew up. I think... this album points to that, and that's what I was really happy about doing.
Bootsy, I have one last question I want to ask you, and I have to admit it is a question I've wanted to ask you for at least 20 years.
Wow. Wow. I hope I can answer it.
I think you can.
Jeez.
Bootsy.
Yeah.
You're a superstar, right?
Twinkle, twinkle, Bobble.
Bootsy Collins, thank you so much for taking the time to come beyond Bullseye.
Oh, thank you so much. Keep that funk alive, baby.
Bootsy Collins. We mentioned it at the top of the show, but he's got a new single called Stars out now. He's using it to raise money for folks working in the music industry who've been impacted by the pandemic. And goodness knows that folks working in the music industry have been impacted by the pandemic. We'll have a link to support the cause on the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. Be your toy. I wanna play for you, boy. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is produced from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California, where my daughter Grace and I just completed our greatest project, our magnum opus, which is from our friend Mark Frauenfelder of Boing Boing's book, Maker Dad. It's like a little gimbal thingy that you attach to a kite string, and then you attach a tiny USB camera to that, and then you fly the kite, and you shoot stable video from a kite. Did this all with a hand drill and some super glue. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio and Jordan Cowling are our associate producers. We get help from Casey O'Brien, who, judging by his social media presence, is currently at a lake house somewhere in Minnesota going insane. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team, thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. You can also keep up with the show on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, and I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Comes this remote control unit.
Oh yeah, I'm programmable. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR. Funky things to play with. Trademark Funk Attack Incorporated.